the final stream for tonight, and I will be back tomorrow night with some other people, Libertas Metapolitics, Blackpilled, The After Party, and Rogue Drones, or Nightmares, who was requested by quite a lot of people. In the meantime, tonight I'm going to end with a stream with Endeavor. Endeavor is a Canadian YouTuber. I met him at the Patriotic Alternative Conference in September, and we recorded a chat there, which is on his channel, and that is what I've linked to in the description. I'll link to it again here in the live chat in case anyone can't see that. So, all right, Endeavor, welcome to Millennial.
Thank you for having me on, Woz. It's always a pleasure.
All right. So, what would you like to say about 2019 and the decade that we're about to leave?
Well, I guess I'll start with kind of my personal experience from 2019. And there's an idea that's been on my mind for several months now, and it has a lot to do with the dissident right, but really just also my personal life. And that's the idea of authenticity. And what's been on my mind is, you know, what we talk about a lot online is the effects that globalism and liberalism and, you know, the ideology of the left really has on things like national identity, tradition, social cohesion. And of course, those are big issues. But really what's been kind of preoccupying my mind lately is more these are very like macro problems. But what's been preoccupying my mind is more the micro problems. And the kind of way that the interpersonal culture that really is created by modern global liberal cosmopolitanism. And really just, I guess I've thought a lot about, you know, my life in the last few years, kind of, because I'm from a major cosmopolitan city, which I moved out of earlier this year. And the one word that comes to my mind when I think of kind of the modern culture that's being fed to us is inauthentic. I mean, I just think that it's a very inauthentic way of life. And this year,
let's talk about what you mean by authentic and what you mean by inauthentic.
So it is something that I've been struggling with because it's hard, something that's hard to describe, but you think that you know it when you see it, though. For me, I think, though, the best way to describe it would be purpose. So something that's authentic is something that has purpose, something that has longevity. And it has a way of like connecting people in ways beyond the material, really. Whereas inauthentic, everything just feels fake, materialistic, disingenuous, and overall just not very life fulfilling. And I know that sounds very vague, but it's really something that is, I guess you can say it's hard to define, but you know it when you see it. What would your definition of something being authentic or inauthentic be?
I don't know. It's not an adjective that I would necessarily think to apply to things. I'm not sure. I think I would say it's something constructive or deconstructive, destructive, let's see. That's probably the way I would look at this. Sorry, I just realized I got some stuck in my beard. Okay. That's probably how I'd look at this. Is something nihilistic, or is it I don't think there is a word for the opposite of nihilistic. Life-giving, nourishing, not necessarily optimistic, but truthful. Does it relate healthily to life as we actually experience it? Or is it a lie, and is it empty and dishonest and or poisonous? Those would be the axes upon which I would want to judge something, I think.
Yeah, because I think one of the aspects that I have been kind of able to identify as inauthentic about modern culture is irony. Everything is ironic, or everything is sarcastic, and that it seems like nothing is really sacred. And what made this come to my mind was kind of some of the interactions that I used to have with back at my university, or with my old work colleagues, which I no longer work with. But I just feels like there's very little way to actually connect with people in any serious way anymore, because it seems like everything is irony. Nothing is nothing's held sacred. So, I mean,
course,
I guess
irony is a way of, apart from anything else, in some people, irony is maliciously used as a destructive thing. They know it's a destructive tool. I think in other people, the young, especially, I'm thinking of myself when I was younger, irony is a defense mechanism. It's a way of avoiding actually nailing your colors to any particular mast and admitting that you believe in something. So you can always be ironic. So you're always being cleverer than anyone who might judge you or you think you are. Mm-hmm. Of course, later on, you grow up, you mature, and you realize, actually, I was being less clever than a lot of people, because I didn't have the balls to you know, stand by something. But of course, part of being young is not being sure of things. So in a way, irony is a very natural thing for the young to gravitate to. And I actually think it's probably not a bad idea for the young. The trouble is, though, that when the actual creators of culture and the curators of culture promote that mindset and have this ironic, sarcastic attitude, because then it's poisonous. They're feeding poison to the young.
Yeah, it's something that both Keith Woods and Morgoth have discussed, that one thing that people seem to be lacking is anything concrete that actually... that you can actually hold as sacred, because it's always deconstruction. It's always things being torn down. And, you know, what really made me think about this is a lot of the interactions I had with people that it feels just like the humor and the kind of the mannerisms that kind of come out of the whole liberal cosmopolitan culture is that it almost feels like they want to turn everything into a joke. So, like one experience that I had recently is that just with this group of people, I couldn't really, I just couldn't stand them, because they just had to kind of make like this wisecracking comment every few minutes. And because it was like almost as if there was nothing else to really say. And it's something that it just, for me at least, it just gets so tiresome. And I guess not to go on that too long, but I guess what I wanted to get to is that I feel like that the dissident right has been a beacon for a lot of people, myself included, of something that is a lot more authentic and a lot more genuine in the modern world. And I think that that's one of the main strengths, because for me, it's just I wanted an alternative to it. I just kind of had enough of the nihilistic culture that that, you know, I was pretty much raised in. And I think that's really one of the things that pushed me in that direction to begin with. I've talked about this in a couple of videos this year, that really kind of my dissatisfaction with modernity in the first place it didn't have to do with, you know, immigration. It didn't have to do with demographics or migrants or stuff like that. What it had to do with was just finding the entire thing nihilistic and finding the entire thing depressing and really just longing for a alternative to that.
Yeah. Would you equate being nihilistic and depressing with a work being, or a culture being, inauthentic?
Yes, I do, because there's nothing really to draw meaning from, I'd say.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think that might be right. One thing I see, and I've said this in a few streams this millennial, is that I think a lot of modern culture is inauthentic in the sense that it simply doesn't match up with real life, and it doesn't help the listener, the consumer of it, to reach any kind of self-knowledge. If anything, it discourages that and helps them to just piss around.
Mm-hmm. Because I do feel that that culture that's more in that's more in line with the natural order is something that feels a lot more authentic and feels a lot more, I guess, fulfilling. Like another idea that's been kicking around in my head lately is the film company Disney, and of course, you know, the garbage that they're churning out today. And one thing that I thought of is, like, Disney in its heyday, because we all know Disney's kind of been a liberal company for a long time, but one of the major themes of Disney in its heyday was hierarchy. Because you think of like the 1990s Disney princesses. Well, what does every little girl love is being a princess. That's a hierarchical position. And I just find like egalitarianism being kind of forced into that culture really just takes away, I think really is for a lot of people. Now, I've never been a huge Disney fan, but is kind of destroying that whole like Disney magic that made them so famous and what everyone is so nostalgic for.
Well, of course, Disney has fallen into hands that are not altogether. I mean, there is clearly a nihilism in Disney now. There's no doubt about it. I'm not even talking about the cartoons. If you just look at the Star Wars films, it's quite. I just heard that the latest one has a lesbian couple in it, for example. One of the characters is revealed to be a lesbian towards the end because she kisses some woman. And, you know, it's all over the place, especially also the feminism, of course, with Rey as this just perfect heroine, I guess, nowadays. So that does away with the distinction between male and female, or at least it asserts that women can do anything a guy can do and probably do it better. So, yes, Disney is a nihilistic company at this point. And I think that, would you like to go more into what you just said about hierarchy in classical Disney?
Well, yeah, it's that if you look at the themes of classical Disney movies, they're all, you know, I know Disney's been around for decades, and I'm not a huge expert on them. I was never a huge fan of them. But the thing that I notice is that it seems to be playing into people's desire for status, desire for hierarchy. And I think, you know, that's what every, you know, young girl loved about people like Snow White or, you know, Beauty and the Beast. These are very hierarchical worlds, really, that they've created. And, you know, right now I'm reading the book War and Peace. And that's a book that is, you know, one of the most famous books of the 19th century. And just the theme throughout it is hierarchy. It's a story about aristocracy and about order. And I feel like that's something that's really been lost in the modern culture, and it's been kind of destroyed for ideological reasons. But I do feel like it's something that is, for many people, life-affirming. And, it's something that you just kind of feel... I always say that, like, egalitarianism really robs people from self-fulfillment. It robs you of excellence. And I feel like that's just why a lot of the that's why I find a lot of the modern Disney movies and a lot of the stuff aimed at kids these days too. It's like it's just it just feels so unnatural because it has these themes of egalitarianism forced into it. Whereas I think that, you know, people just I think that hierarchy is, first of all, the natural order, but also something that is life affirming for many people. Even if you're not, you know, the person at the top of the hierarchy, I mean. And any young girl could love a Disney princess. Any young man could, you know, dream of being a knight. That you don't need to be high class to enjoy that kind of story and to really aspire to that.
Well, I mean, even the title Beauty and the Beast implies hierarchy because one of the women is being called a beauty. That implies that, you know, some girls aren't beautiful. So. I think even right there, I mean, would that be allowed now? Because I think nowadays we have to assert that, you know, fat is beautiful and disabled is beautiful and ugly is beautiful and so on. So I'm not sure that you would even get away with that title nowadays.
Yeah, and I think that just plays into kind of what you had said is that the problem is that you're being given a culture that doesn't line up with reality. People know what is beautiful, what is true, good, and beautiful, and what isn't. You, no matter what you say in the media, no matter what some professor at some university says, people know who a beautiful woman is. People know who, you know, a masculine man is, and you know, no amount of critical theory is going to change that in people. And I feel like that's just a big gap in modern culture, and I guess. It's something that really I think is an opportunity for the dissident right to exploit because I think, you know, we don't shy away from hierarchy. We kind of see it as the natural order. And you were just speaking with Reactionary Expat about producing art. And, you know, I feel like that's something that people really are longing for, is order, really.
I agree. And I do think that's true, that people are looking for a way out of the chaos of post-modernity. Nowadays, there's very little to hold on to. There's very little to guide you. Indeed, the advice time and time again is just do whatever is right for you. But of course, a young person, but even a lot of not so young people, don't know what is right for them or what feels right. I mean, it's all very all over the place. It's chaotic. You'll tell yourself this thing is right for me, but then discover 5 years later, actually, it wasn't right for me. And that I was just sort of fumbling around. I didn't know. So people clearly do need guidance, and they need something to attach themselves to and to have faith in. I think that is just obvious. And the only thing, because I'm just imagining what a progressive would say to that, and they would say, well, we are giving people something to attach themselves to and have faith in, and that's the idea of equality. But that's the whole point. It's like saying, believe in poison, but build with sand. It's not going to work.
Yeah, the other thing that I've also kind of come to, because kind of detaching myself from the progressive communities and city and the workplace, university, I've detached myself from that. And the biggest relief for me is just being away from the viciousness. Because what I guess from, I already knew this, of course, being inside it, but now that I've been able to step away from that and look back in, it just feels like it's just constant hostility. Like it seems to just bring out the worst in people. And I guess the ultimate irony is that there's this talk of love and equality and inclusion, but it just is constantly, has this cloud of animosity and just cruelty over it. And I guess just like that was kind of what was, for me at least in the past, kind of contributing to what I kind of felt was like, inauthentic way of life. And, it's just like goes into the cancer that I find really kind of liberalism and the culture that comes with it really is.
So what, if that is where you were a year ago, how would you contrast that with today? What is different now?
Well, for me personally, I've made a lot of life changes. What I'm not going to say exactly where I am right now, what I'm doing, but basically I took my old life and smashed it on the ground. I had enough of it. And, in the last year I've, moved out of my parents' house, got a real respectable job. And I guess also been searching out more immaterial things. Like, for example, I used to be a huge gamer. I used to be playing 3 hours of video games a day. But I guess, I know it sounds really cliched, but, removing yourself from that and actually seeking out something immaterial is, for me at least, has been a big relief. And I'd say that a large part of being able to do that is the connections you make through the internet and through social media. I think that one of the most positive things that YouTube has done for me is it opens the door for you to actually engage with people outside of the kind of progressive paradigm that you're so desperate to escape. And a good example of that for me this year is when I went to England, when I went to the United Kingdom and my trip there, where I met you and several other members of the dissident right. So it's really just been kind of removing the negative influences and really kind of searching out new ones.
I know that you did a video about reflections on your travels, and particularly on Britain. But is there anything you'd say now and here about what that did for you visiting Britain?
Yes, because I'm ethnically Scottish. I believe it was my great grandparents were the latest generation to have lived in Scotland. Oh no, actually, I believe it would be my great great grandparents, but I'm not actually entirely sure. So my family's been in Canada for about 130 years. So I'd say that one of the most important things for me is it does kind of feel like a connection to something that is a bit deeper inside of you, that you do kind of feel like you're reaching further back and, you know, reaching something that kind of is you are part of and kind of your ancestors are part of. And I'd also say that I did see a lot of positives in the UK when I was there, because you can go on about the negatives all day. You can go on about the demographic situation, the knife crime and all this stuff. And, I fully understand all those problems, but I was expecting that. I already knew that, you know, London is going to be the way it is. I already knew that, you know, Manchester is the way it is. But I would say that I actually saw a lot more positives than I expected to. And one of those is, I think you guys have a really good community in the UK. I think that, it's really encouraging the work that you guys are doing there. And, I'm hoping that in, North America, we can have that in 2-3 years.
Yes, I would hope so as well. There have been a lot of, problems with, cohesion in the movement in America. I think in Britain it seems to be much more comparatively much more harmonious, which is not to say that we don't have problems here, but we do. But on the whole, I think things usually work, and there aren't many traitors or shills or infiltrators, whatever. So yeah, I think there's also just a sort of positive attitude, more or less. I think that's something that where you experienced it, that was really the first, that was the first PA conference, the first PA gathering, as far as I know. And so that is a new start. It's quite exciting.
Yeah. And, I find that a lot of the things I appreciated are not even necessarily politics related. I mean, for example, probably my favorite part of the trip is I actually visited Morgoth in his small village in the Northeast, and just having him show me the forest and the rocks and the trees and the little places where he says he goes fishing and stuff. Like, that's something that no tourist could ever really experience. Like, because when you go visit a country, you go see the attractions, you stay at a hotel, you go on these guided tours, but that's something that is like genuine, that is not that you do not really get to have sold to you. And that's really something very few people who aren't of that little locality ever get to experience. And another example was one thing I did was I actually when I was in Scotland, what I did was I actually went to the train station. I picked a random station. I didn't know where I was going, just maybe one that's 20, 30 minutes away. I took the train there and I walked for 5 kilometers one direction, 5 kilometers another, and then made my way back. And I came across this this abandoned schoolhouse, and I just loved that, because it was something that no tourist ever gets to see. But that is something that is like, so it looked like it was maybe probably 150 years old or so. And it's something that's like just kind of sunken into the land. Like, you can tell that is an authentic part of the land, even though it's not really used anymore. And yeah, it was just something that really resonated with me a lot. Just that little schoolhouse on some farm, which I don't know where it is. Probably will never be able to find it again. But yeah, it's just those little things.
That's interesting. I think that's a really good way for someone, a white person from the New World, to explore the old world. I think that's how I would advise them to. I think I actually did advise you to do something like that. I know I didn't obviously didn't specify find an old schoolhouse somewhere, but I think I did tell you to just wander around, and I think that that's probably the best thing to do, because we did, and people will maybe watch our talk that I've linked to in the description, but I think I did say that I don't think that identity and history, heritage and so on is a matter of knowing specific facts and statistics. Those are relevant and helpful in some ways, but the core of identity is experience and absorbing climates, atmospheres, cultures in that way, I think, simply by being there and observing, and not really, and just with quite an open mind, you know, not even comparing it to other things, judging it, analyzing it, but simply experiencing it. I think there's a lot to be said for approaching these things in an innocent way. Now, what would you say about that?
Absolutely, because, you know, one thing that I really don't like is guided tours. I think I mentioned this in the video too. One thing that, I love history. I love to read like facts about things. I want to know like which, you know, emperor built this thing, what, who did what, when. But the thing is, I can do that on Wikipedia. I can do that before I go or after I go. But when I'm at a place, I want to feel the place. I don't need to be lectured about it. Like, for example, when I was I visited Moscow this year also in Russia. One spot that I just found, this spot that it's between Red Square and the Bolshoi Theater, the big opera house. And I sat there for probably around, you know, maybe up to an hour. And, I guess just, absorbing the feeling of that atmosphere. And yeah, I mean, that's the way that, at least for me personally, that's the best way to experience history in an authentic way, really.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not decrying learning about history and reading books and so on. I just think that there's something to be said for going into it, you know, just giving yourself to a place, giving yourself to a culture, and just seeing what it does, what it shows you. Yes. So, yeah, I think that's a good. I'm really glad that you had that experience when you were in Scotland. Honestly. I'm actually tempted to do it myself, something similar to it. Next year, something I want to do is just wander around England. I've been talking about doing it. I've been thinking about doing it since 2017. And to be honest, I kind of wish I'd just done it then when it occurred to me, because it was at the right time of year. But I didn't do it. And then I was thinking about doing it this year, but I was a mess, so I didn't do it. But I want to do it next year. I want to just wander, much like I did with America in 2016. I'd like to, in the middle of next year, summer, just literally walk. Not take the train, not take the bus, not take cars, but walk around England and maybe even sleep rough and just see how it goes and film things and, you know, talk about what I'm seeing. Talk about where I've been and so on. Very much living like a vagrant. I know it sounds kind of insane, but I'm sort of really driven to do this. As I say, I've been thinking about it for 2.5 years now. And I think I should do it now because I'm going to be, eventually I'll be too old to withstand, maybe too old to do this. I might be, you could say I'm too old already to do something so ridiculous, but what I mean is physically too old to withstand it. So it's something that I definitely want to do and sort of just give myself to the English countryside and see what happens. Someone says Woe's returning to his art school roots. Perhaps this is something that I should have done when I was at art school. I mean, it does seem something, I know it's crazy. I know it's a kind of silly idea, but I really think it could be fascinating, and I definitely think it could lead to a lot of interesting content in terms of, you know, making video, a travelogue of this experience, which I imagine would last for about a month. I don't think it would be short. I wouldn't want to do it for a week. That doesn't seem nearly enough. I think it would have to be about a month or maybe 6 weeks. And so that it's a proper odyssey. And I'd see a lot of the country, the place, towns, villages, even a few cities that I've never been to, and lots of countryside. So I think it would be fascinating. That's one of the things I intend to do next year, if it's feasible. So, yeah, sorry about that diversion endeavor. Please go ahead.
Oh, no. Because, you know, a lot of times people get so like down and get so black-pilled. And, you know, I think that the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems you can, one of the biggest mistakes you can make is that whilst, you know, I think the internet, whilst YouTube, it can be a good tool to, you know, connect with other people, find like-minded people. It really is only a gateway to that. And you can't get absorbed into the YouTube cycle. I know you were talking about this in the previous stream also, that you know, there just seems to be this outrage cycle that people get caught up in. You know, like Antifa will do something, and then, you know, Tim Pool will have like a, you know, 10 tweet rant about, oh my God, I can't believe they did this. And, you know, when you get stuck into that, you know, I find that the internet and politics and YouTube and that stuff, it kind of becomes, it becomes that beast that of the, of making you that atomized, angry individual. And that's why, you know, I'm not a full-time YouTuber. I don't want it to become my life for that very reason, because I don't want it to turn me into kind of this atomized atomized individual who, you know, just spends their entire time angry about things. So I think for a lot of people,
Expat and I were talking about that in the previous stream. Of course, it's something that we naturally did. We naturally ended up doing that after the migrant crisis and so on. It was a natural thing for people to just try to digest this situation, that this bizarre thing that was going on, and coming to grips with multiculturalism, the reality of Islam, and all this kind of thing, and of course race realism. So there is a necessary phase, but I'm through with it now, and I think that a lot of people are as well. Other people are as well. So the question then is, okay, so now what? We've done the moaning, we've done the outrage. Now what? We need to find a healthy way to live with this situation.
Yeah, because you can't just you know, being more angry on the internet and posting that, like, you know, that 11 tweets instead of 10, that doesn't really change the situation and just kind of makes it worse. So I think definitely everyone needs to kind of find a outlet that's not politics related. Like you had mentioned, you know, if going on a hike around England or something like that, or, you know, just I just stress people that, you know, the fight you're really against is like is modernity, really. And you can't conquer it on the internet. You can't conquer it by, you know, complaining about it online. You have to actually go out and make something change. And also, kind of like you had said that earlier, that the politics isn't going to change right away. There's really nothing you can do about that today. You can only really change the culture first. And that's kind of what I'm more interested in now. I'm more interested in doing things cultural and kind of exploring the personal experience, because I don't want to always be, you know, a black pill channel. And
of course not. Yeah. I think that we, in a way, we have a almost a moral duty to not be black, to at least try to transcend the black pill. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
at least try to. I mean, if someone's not even trying to, I can get someone failing. I can forgive that, but someone not even trying to, someone just marinating in the black pill, like certain Swedish Twitterers we could mention, Peter Sweden. I think it's really just loathsome. I think it's immoral, because all you're doing is deliberately getting other people down.
Yeah, and, you know, I find that there is still, like, things out there that can really just make that I think are really just positive. And, you know, you don't need to, you know, as everyone knows, the mainstream culture is shit. Like, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the stream, you know, I think that for me, though, the biggest liberating thing is escaping from it. You know, everybody hates the new Star Wars movie. I didn't watch it. You know, everyone was they were making a big deal about the Joker. Didn't watch it. You know, Tim Pool's or Andy Ngo are going off about Antifa. Oh my God, they're the real fascists. You know, just don't follow them on Twitter. I made a video this year about the films Gettysburg and Gods and Generals, and it's probably the video that I am most proud of. Probably of the videos that I've edited, written, and produced. I'd say that's probably my favorite one. And what I talked about in that video was just how the film had so many themes. And the impact it had on me as a 17-year-old boy when I saw them. There's all the themes of that really I felt I was really lacking. Like it's not even a really political film, but the themes of masculinity, the themes of homeland, the themes of, you know, of struggle, of war. And of course, you know, no one's saying, obviously, the far right, you know, we're anti-war these days, but still the idea of struggle. And it's just things like this that I find are the most positive influence on people. You know, and for me, that it was these two Civil War films that I saw when I was 17. This was two life-changing films for me. And I think you definitely can, there's definitely things out there that you can find that are positive for you. And, you know, you really need to be looking for those, because you can't just be marinating in the negativity all the time.
Definitely not. I think it becomes a sort of addiction. To completely change the subject momentarily, somebody has made a donation and is asking me to do an American accent. So I kind of feel almost like I've got to do it. So, okay. Here we go then, Robert. Since you've asked, I would have to say something like, "Oh my God, pass the butter." There you go.
It's good, but it sounds a bit forced though.
It was forced. It was very forced, but I didn't want to let the guy down. So, okay. So let's return. That's that diversion over with. Thank you, Robert. So was there anything else that you would say, like, that you came back from Britain to Canada with? I mean, what other ways did it enlighten you or change you? Or was it, go for it.
I'd also say that one thing I took away from it is that I feel that the process of globalization and the process of, subversion, I feel like metapolitically, you know, our enemies played their hand a lot better in the United States and Canada. It feels like, and I think I know why that is. It's because they're historically younger nations, and and also they were colonial nations, so they were one set up by settlers. I feel guilty about that. It's actually something I'm proud of. But my takeaway in Britain is that it seems like it's a lot more unnatural. So you almost saw, I mean, from at least my perspective, you know, being from some giant cosmopolitan city, it kind of just looks like it's always been that way. You know, I sometimes come across some old, you know, historical site and think, oh, that looks cool, but you know, it doesn't reflect the rest of it. But it kind of felt though in Britain as if you had taken two different worlds and kind of smushed them together. So you had the traditional nation state being kind of like devoured by this, you know, disease of globalism and this disease of multiculturalism. And one thing that was striking for me was I visited the city Newcastle, and it was really nice. It was probably of the big cities that I visited, it was probably my favorite one. One thing was that it looked like a traditional European city. So it had this like 800-year-old church. It had all these stone buildings, these squares. But then you go toward the when I was had to leave, I had to go toward the bus stop, and there was this giant, you know, blue cylinder, which was a university. And you could see behind it all these modernist apartment buildings. And I couldn't believe that this was real, but they had this
show. Some of the ways in which they defile classical architecture with modern monstrosities. You know, the modern monstrosities are bad enough, but the fact that they put them in the proximity of classical buildings, or even attach them physically to classical buildings, is just awful.
Yeah, and not only that, but when I had to go to the bus stop to leave, I inadvertently walked to the LGBT neighborhood, and they had this demonstration called the Lady Boys of Bangkok. And I just thought, like, the fact that that's like, you know, 100 meters away from a 800-year-old church, like, it's just a disgrace. Like, like I said, it felt like, you know, you're taking,
see, that, you know, globalism. Just before you go, I'm laughing because I mentioned in a previous millennial that I once went to a show of the Lady Boys of Bangkok a long, long time ago.
Oh, no.
A long time ago, before I was reactionary. And it's just nonsense. I don't care about that kind of thing going on in the demimonde, but when, as you say, in the proximity of a church, it cannot, I mean, there's just no way that you can justify that.
Yeah, it just kind of felt like, you know, that it was kind of a, like I said, like a disease kind of just eating away at a traditional European nation state. The other thing I also been on my mind is the idea of kind of what comes next. Because for me, I think one of the ways that I've kind of spit out the black pill and kind of become a lot more positive is accepting that you're not going to be able to put the world back together as it was in 1965. Because, you know, I think that a lot of people, when they kind of first start to realize the problem, they realize that, you know, our countries have been subverted and that it's been going on for the last 75 years since the very end of World War II. You kind of think, oh my God, you know, we've been sold out. How are we going to like recover from this? But for me, I think that what has brought more positivity for me, and especially in the last year, is kind of acknowledging that it's going to be something new and positive that comes out of this. And I think especially that's the case in North America, because, you know, I have a great appreciation for my heritage and a great appreciation for the land in Canada and our history, our culture, what's left of it. But, you know, I have to also acknowledge that that's not going to exist as it did in the future. And probably that what comes out of it, you know, it can reflect your ancestors, but it's not going to be it's not going to be the way it was. But I think the best you can do is build something new that reflects them. Because like another dilemma I had this year, and I made a BitChute video about this, because I do a few exclusives on BitChute now, was about Remembrance Day in 2011. And basically, or sorry, not 2011, this year, 2019. Basically what had happened was, just like, you know, basically everything these days, it became a racism witch hunt in Canada. Famous Canadian broadcaster, you know, hockey coach Don Cherry got fired for saying the phrase "you people."
Yes.
And what really struck me about that is that the propaganda that is put out by the Canadian government, by the media, and all that, it's all just, you know, global homo propaganda, really. There's no hiding the agenda that's going on there. Everybody knows, especially when it comes to Canada. But then, you know, there's this one week a year that you see all these images of white Canadian men in uniform, you know, going off to fight at Vimy Ridge or at Juno Beach. And it just feels like a huge contrast. But, you know, I think this year it was the first year I kind of really was able to realize that it's not really genuine. So, you know, one thing that I'd say that might actually be controversial is that I actually support them abolishing that symbology. I you know, like I would have felt a few years ago when I was, you know, maybe not as red-pilled, that, you know, this was something that I was very passionate about. It made me feel proud of my country and stuff. But I don't want a government that really wants to destroy us using our own symbology. And I wish they would abolish these things, because I want that to be the symbology of the dissident right. I want, you know, us to use that, the images of our war heroes gone by, because I think that we are the true, you know, the people that are truly representing what they would have wanted.
Yeah, and it would actually be more honest. I mean, at least everyone would be able to see, okay, our flag is you know, some sort of rainbow casserole, and that accurately represents the reality of the country as it is today, the government, the state as it is today. You know, at least then there wouldn't be this constant assault going on by, you know, applying old traditional symbology to modern degeneracy.
Mm-hmm. And I also find that it also, if you actually wish for mainstream institutions to use that, you kind of have to lie and misrepresent it. So, you know, you'll have a lot of people saying, well, they weren't, they were anti-racist. They fought the Nazis and they were, you know, they were fought for multiculturalism and liberalism and stuff like that. When that's just a lie, you know, the men that fought in World War II, for both sides, they didn't get what they wanted. And I don't want mainstream institutions, which really their goal is to destroy the descendants of them, I don't want them using that symbology. So I think, you know, I think you'd mentioned in the last stream about them tearing down statues and removing names and stuff like that. I think the best way forward is that you have to kind of claim those as your own. And like you said, it's going to happen no matter what. I think it's the best thing to do is to really to reclaim those, because they shouldn't be represented by people that don't, that in their long-term goal is to get rid of them.
Yeah, indeed. Somebody asks, what are your thoughts about Quebec?
About Quebec, it's really interesting, because it seems like that's the only form of nationalism, albeit civic, that's allowed. But then, you know, again, it kind of suffers the same fate as, say, like Irish or Scottish, quote unquote, nationalism. That what it actually is globalist, to borrow a phrase from Orwell and Good, globalist gerrymandering. That, you know, the Scottish, they hate the English, but they want to separate so that they can be ruled by Brussels, and then they can have more mass immigration from the third world. That's kind of the state of Quebec nationalism. It's not really true nationalism in any sense. You know, I guess throughout Canadian history, there's always been this kind of divide between the Anglo and French Canada. But for me, I have no interest in old, you know, trifles. It's really something that doesn't interest me. Because, I mean, like I said, you know, you're not going to have the country of 1965 back. That's just not going to happen. Something new is going to have to come out of that. And, I mean, I'm pretty sure that, if nothing happens, Anglo and French Canada are going to cease to exist by the end of the century if nothing else changes. So, you know, I think that going forward, it's really a kind of trifle that we should put behind ourselves. Like, I have no interest in, you know, hating the French Canadians.
Yeah, I have a similar attitude with the English, especially because I live in England. Yeah. And even when I lived in Scotland, I had, I thought it was silly. There are various old animosity, what would be the word, antagonisms, whatever, that really need to be put away, I think, because there are massive problems on the horizon. And I think that these old conflicts just are not, they have to be not relevant anymore. We have to make them not relevant anymore. Because if they are relevant to us, they will get in the way of us uniting and constructively, you know, collaborating to defeat new problems.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know there's the cliche, no more brother wars, but yeah, it's true. I mean, and not only that, I do think that there is going to be a very big shifting of the map when, if we are successful, and that, you know, something new is going to come out of that. So, you know, you could end up with a situation where, who knows, maybe people from different nation states end up living in the same one. Maybe they, because a lot of intermixing is going on. I mean, I think you pointed out in another stream that in America, essentially, there doesn't really exist, you know, the European ethnicities that move to America anymore. It's kind of become a white American ethnicity out of the I guess you could say melting pot. I know that's not entirely accurate, but I just find like there's going to be something new that comes out of that, because in the case of Canada, I don't think that there's going to be, you know, be a French Canada and English Canada, and they're going to be, you know, rivals with each other. I just think that something new is going to come out of that, really. And you don't know who's going to be involved in that.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll turn to super chats now. And so if anyone's got any questions for Endeavor, please post them in the super chat. Here is the link. There you go. All right, so I did a trip. This is from Charlemagne. I did a trip to France where I traveled around the battlefields of the Great War completely alone. He's talking to me. You should do the Scottish trip you were talking about. It will be a very good experience for you. To be clear, I was talking about doing England, and that's not because I don't want to do Scotland. I just think I should do them separately. I think I would want to do England first and then Scotland maybe the next year. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But yeah, there you go. So I think it is an interesting, it's a sort of pilgrimage style sort of thing, or a very solitary experience, but I think it would be fascinating. I'm very, very drawn to doing it, to the idea and to doing it.
The other thing that has been on my mind is, like, when it comes to Canadians, Americans, and, you know, I guess people from, I guess you could say colonials, whatever you want to call them. I do feel that, at least for me personally, I do think that there's a, I kind of have a much more now pan-European appreciation, because I can't really, I guess my heritage is not like deep enough that I can say, well, I am of this, you know, group. I am of this, this one European ethnic group, because really we kind of all are this hodgepodge of, different ethnicities. Like, for example, I mean, I'm mostly Scottish, but I think I also have Irish and some French in me. And I find that with a lot of people, that's kind of what's going to be what appeals to them, because, you know, it's really difficult for you to really identify with, say, being an Italian American or a Irish American, or, you know, all what used to exist maybe 100 years ago. And I think that there's a lot of value in kind of finding meaning in the wider context of Europe, because you don't really have one to identify with, in at least especially not in North America. So I think that you can draw influence from many different many different places, and I don't think it's something that people should, you know, be just really asinine over, because in all fairness, I think there's probably a lot more similarities to me, between me and, say, an American from, I don't know, Ohio or something like that, than there would be to, you know, it would pretty much be interchangeable at this point. There's not that much of a difference. So I think, you know, don't be too asinine over these small differences. I think, you know, you can, I like to look at kind of the wider context of Western civilization in Europe. And, you know, I draw a lot of inspiration from that too.
Okay. Here's a question. You've posted this in the live chat. Please do not post questions in the live chat, because I probably won't see them. Post them on Entropy, please. Just for the sake of my stress levels. Okay, now somebody asks, can you get Endeavor to give his opinion on the 1917 Nickel Resolution Canadian titles debate, if he has one, an opinion?
I'm sorry, I haven't read up enough on that.
Okay. All right, so I'll move on to the next super chat. Okay. Any advice for a nationalist who, for career reasons, is living abroad in a non-white country, i.e. Taiwan? How can I contribute to the cause? I'll give my advice here first. The first one, you can certainly contribute financially by donating, as you've done here with a super chat. That's the most obvious thing that I would say, and not because forgive me, that sounds like shilling or whatever, but it is just the most, it's just the most obvious thing to say. If you can't help directly, you can help by supporting financially. Now, in terms of other stuff, you could create an organization for expats in that country where you're living. You could just organize meetups. I think that's a good idea. You could create a blog, a vlog, that kind of thing. Or you could plot your course back home, which I would say might be a good idea. So, yeah, that's what I would say. So, Endeavor, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, what I'd say is that, yeah, you can help by donating. And also maybe, I'd just say while you're there, read books, you know, find some kind of cultural outlet that you appreciate and that you can contribute to. And, you know, with the power of the internet, you can definitely send some of that back our way. And, yeah, I'd say just look for what you can create while you're there. You know, I don't know if it should be forever. That is up to you. I know that there are several content creators like On the Offensive and Chris Dangerfield. They do great work. I think that, you know, they're definitely big positives to the cause. They live, I believe, in Southeast Asia. But yeah, I'd say either financially donate, find people there that you can connect with. Or I'd say you should also maybe look for cultural creation. Can I actually ask you a question, Woz? Is what do you think of people living in other European nations? So like, I know you lived in Germany for a few years. Do you think that that's different from moving to somewhere like Taiwan? Or would you say that people should be rooted in the one that they're born in?
Well, I lived there for 2 years, and it wasn't necessity exactly. I had a German girlfriend, and after I was doxxed, I first wandered for a while and then settled with her, and that was why I stayed there for about a year, almost a year and a half. So I'm not bothered about this. It's a very bloody complicated issue. I mean, the issue of national identities and national cultures, and even the gene pools, the genetics. The first thing you should be aware of is that these different strands of these different ethnicities within Europe have only, I might be wrong about this, but I believe they've only existed for about 4,000 years. It's not like something that's, you know, geologically ancient. However, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be preserved. So then you've got the question of, well, how different actually are they anyway? Not that different. But then you've got the question of, they still are something different and discrete, surely. And of course they are. There is a German phenotype, there is a British, a Northern English phenotype, a Southern English phenotype, a Scottish phenotype. So these things are real. But I think that globalism is a reality, or rather globalization is a reality. And I'm not sure how much we should strive to preserve of the past, of history. It might be more trouble than it's actually worth. I don't like giving into the leftist bromide that change is inevitable, life is change. But it is. I mean, it's kind of true. So the issue is, again, what to preserve? What are you going to put energy into preserving? And it's actually not that important. Is it more important that we have vital cultures, vital genetic organisms in terms of groups in the here and now, or is it more important that we try to preserve has existed up till now? And I should say that I'm, and this is something where I definitely should declare my own bias or whatever, which is that I'm only half Scottish ancestrally. I'm only, and then three quarters British genetically, or not even, sorry, ancestrally, and then a quarter Italian. But according to 23andMe, I'm not even half British. I'm like 43% British. So it is, you know, I'm not like the most British person in the world, or definitely not the most Scottish person in the world. So it is a bit weird for me. I am a sort of Euro mutt, even though I hate that phrase. I think it's a sort of evil phrase, but I am one. So I'm kind of conflicted. I tend to think this is something that you could really overthink and tie yourself in knots in. And probably it's better if we don't worry too much about it. Don't let it consume us. In the end, life is what you make it, and culture is what we collectively make it, and nations are what we collectively make them. And we have to start from where we are. We have to start with what we have. Now, I'm not going to become some sort of crazed globalist just saying, well, because I'm a Euromutt, therefore nothing matters. And culture, it's all just a load of piss, really. You know, I'm not going to become a nihilist. So I think that we have to try to be sensible. But it is a bloody complicated issue.
Yeah, I guess my opinion on that is that I think that, like you had mentioned, that they say change is inevitable. But, you know, when the left say that, what they mean is that you're going to be replaced and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, that's obviously not true. But yeah, in many ways, change is inevitable. Because I actually have done the same. I actually spent several months in Eastern Europe before. And I actually speak a decent amount of Russian. But what I'd say is that, you know, if you actually are interested in another European culture and, you know, you find and you actually like would like to make a you know, considerable effort to actually try to fit into that, I don't really think you should be that asinine over, you know, the fact that, well, you know, you're from you're from America and you're moving to Canada, or you're from Canada and you're moving to Britain or something like that. How can you possibly say that you're, you know, against globalism? Because, you know, I think, you know, a lot of that intermixing kind of, it's kind of happened already. That doesn't mean, you know, you need to accept that. That's far from saying, you know, you accept the great replacement. What it's saying is that a lot of that, kind of is inevitable. And I think that, you know, it is something that if you genuinely want to, you know, you have a better life in another nation, I'm not totally against people actually exploring that. However, I also think that it's not something that you can really say that is, it's like a solution. So you can't say like, you know, it's like escaping from the problem, because it isn't. But yeah, I guess that's kind of my view on that. Because I actually, someone had posed me that question when I was at the Patriotic Alternative Conference. They asked me, you know, what do you think about Americans, Canadians coming back to Europe? And do you think that it'd be good for you? And what I said was that if you genuinely want to fit into that and you think, you know, that's, you'll have a better life there, then yeah, I think you should. But at the same time, you have to understand that you do have to make a concerted effort to fit in there, because, you know, you're not, there still is those cultural differences. So that you, oh, that you'll have
absolutely
to overcome.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. And this is something that I'll probably talk about in the future. I think that in spite of the genetic stuff, because, you know, and someone said I'm probably an outlier anyway, probably maybe most British people of my generation are still more British genetically than I am. I hope so, but I don't know. That's the thing. It's a bit surprising. But anyway, leaving aside the genetic thing, culturally, there, of course, I mean, there's undoubtedly such a thing as British culture and British attitude towards life and towards the world. And you could divide that into a Scottish attitude, a Scottish psyche, and an English psyche. I think these are very real things. And I mean, I'm not going to, like, honestly, I'm not becoming a globalist. Don't worry. I'm just trying to be realistic and not absolutist about this stuff. Mm-hmm. But someone else did make the point, there's a big difference between being a European crossbreed who knows your background and being a globalized mongrel. And I think that is very, very, a very salient point, because, I mean, I'm not talking about identity should mean nothing and we're just consumers. You know, we're just sort of chocolate, coffee-colored consumers. That seems hellish to me. It really just seems awful. It's empty. I'm just saying, is it that bad if someone is half Norwegian and half German? Probably.
No, I don't really think it is.
Does anyone really give a fuck? No, I don't think so. However, obviously, I would prefer if most Germans were fully German and most Norwegians were fully Norwegian, because then there is something, there is a something and another something. And then the crossbreed is just a cross, it's just an anomaly, it's just something a wee bit interesting and novel and unusual, you know?
The other thing is, you have to also take into account that the dissident right is international. I know it claims to be a nationalist movement, but the truth is it's an international movement. Like, you know, I'm a Canadian, you're Scottish, there's Americans, there's Germans, there's French, Swedish, and, you know, you name it. It's an international movement. And, you know, as much as I love the idea of nationalism, I love the idea of the nation state, you also have to understand that just a lot of it, just through culture, has actually bled into each other. And I mean, there is a way. And then, you know, why do I identify, you know, with people in other nations who, you know, I've never met before, or that, you know, maybe it's not like directly related to my own genetic line, but, you know, that you can have that appreciation. And, you know, and for you know, globalism, well, not globalism, but kind of the globalization is a reality. And the, I think in that sense, the dissident right has to be a kind of international movement in a sense.
Yes. And I think that almost every movement, certainly anything that's based online or that emerged online, is going to be like that. I made this point a long time ago in a video. Which one was it? Oh, I've no idea now. But I made this point that, you know, people watch my videos who are not British. Most my subscribers are not British. So therefore, it's a bit, this is a reality that you've got to somehow reconcile. I don't really know what to say about it. I don't know. Maybe in the future I'll have a lot more British followers, and then the Americans will just be an incidental thing. Where, yeah, most of them are American, but there are still, I'm still making a cultural impact in Britain, which is my primary concern. I think that's probably what I would want. I think that's the situation I would want. But then I feel like, well, I'm neglecting my American followers. So it's a bit confusing. But anyway, I think that, yes, the alt-right, the dissident right, and all this is an international phenomenon. That's just a fact, because it's undeniable. That's the way it emerged. So, but then, you know, I don't think there's a contradiction. I don't, in international nationalism. You know, I know that some people have tried, like our enemies, that some people have tried to say, oh, it's a contradiction in terms, but it's really not. It's just a bunch of people in different countries who think that caring about your country is important. It's not a fucking contradiction. Sorry, I shouldn't be swearing. Yeah, it's not a contradiction.
Yeah, it's kind of a question that you have to answer, because the other problem is that the forces that are really attacking these various nations, those forces are international. That's why they call it globalism. You know, it's the same forces, the same people attacking, you know, the British, the French, the Americans, Canadians, unit. It's an international force of globalism that's really attacking Western nations right now. And, you know, you can't really just say to yourself that, well, you're just this one little country that needs to just win. We just need to, you know, win our national election and elect like this one great leader, because I think one of the realities is that certain nations that are like really small, I don't think they can stand alone. You know, that's why I think a lot of these smaller nations, like say Ireland or maybe even Scotland, they kind of are a lot more pressured into giving into the push for globalism, because they don't have that clout on the international stage.
It's also a way for them to grovel for approval from powerful entities like the UN, the EU, and so on. We are more progressive than our more powerful but less progressive neighbours in England. It's really pathetic.
Oh, that's basically become Canada's national identity, being more progressive than the United States.
Yes, I heard that. I think, was it JF? I had another Canadian on, and we were making that point. All right, I mean, the question of identity, and I see some people not pleased with what I said earlier. Sorry. It's something that I might want to make a dedicated video about, just meditating on this thing, because it is an extraordinarily complex subject. And I don't like the idea of hogging a live stream, which is really supposed to be about Endeavor, by doing that. So, and also I'm very tired. It's 3:30 in the morning now. So, okay, we'll move on to the next super chat. I feel like Australians are regularly left out. Go being acknowledged in conversation. Is it because we don't have such an impactful relationship, unlike America? Well, it's we've got at least two Australians here and the Franklin in the live chat. So there are Australians listening to me. I think it's just because America has come up in the conversation with Endeavor quite a lot. But Canada has always also come up. But America is obviously, I mean, it's the superpower today. So how can you not talk about it? It becomes relevant in your thoughts, in your daily life, and in all sorts of, you know, unexpected ways. It just keeps popping up. It's a relevant thing. So as for Australia, yeah, it's not that I have anything particularly against Australia. It's just that it's not as got as much of a footprint on the world stage as America has. So I'm sorry if you feel neglected. It's not deliberate.
I guess what I'd say is that I see Canada kind of on the same footing as Australia. You know, we're not nearly as influential as America. But you also have to remember that the metapolitical battles that go on in America affect Canada and Australia and Europe, to be honest, very strongly.
Of course. And if we're going to say all of this, we should also mention New Zealand, of course.
Yeah, New Zealand, South Africa, even, we can mention. But yeah, the metapolitics that goes on in these countries, especially the influential ones, that affects all of them. So like, for example, the Trump phenomenon, that dominated the news in Canada for 2 years. It was bigger news than the Canadian elections, really. And it's because metapolitics these days is global, just like this entire, the entire battle. It's global metapolitics, really, that's going on. And America is very influential in that respect.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, another question from an Australian. I am an Australian, both Cornish and German parents. I feel lost with no identity here. When I travel in England, I feel at home. Would I be welcomed without animosity as I'm basically a rootless Euro? From my point of view, yeah. I really wouldn't have any problem with that. You're Cornish, so you say both Cornish and German parents. Does that mean that one parent's Cornish, one's German? So that means you're half English. I mean, and then the other half is German. So, you know, I really, from my point of view, I would have no objection whatsoever to someone like you migrating to England or to Britain. So that's my perspective. But again, as someone pointed out, I am a bit of an outlier.
Yeah. That basically is pretty similar to my situation. I'd say that if it resonates with you, dude, I'd say try it out. I'm sure no one's gonna. I'm sure no one's gonna, you know, say, well, this guy is half German and he's born in Australia. He's not welcome at our meeting, you know.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays
it's just asinine.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I think it is just asinine. At this point, we're dealing with incursions of large, very, very large numbers of people from completely different parts of the world, and to quibble over something like that, I think it's just kind of silly. I understand why someone would, but I think it's very idealistic and short and sort of naive of them to do it, like short-sighted. So, okay, let's move on. I should have perhaps been more sympathetic to that guy because he said he felt like he had no identity. And I think that's a real shame. And I would just say to you, move back to Europe. Move to Europe. It's probably where your soul belongs. Either in Germany, experiment with that, or England, Britain, experiment with that. I think that quite a lot of people in the New World have that same feeling, especially as their countries become just globalized shopping malls. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to explore Europe this year, is because, Canada is, I totally feel the same way. I mean, as much as I love our history and our heritage, the lived experience of it is actually very isolating. So what I'd say to that guy is give it a shot. Really, I mean, if you don't like it, you can always go back. But if that resonates with you and that you live a more fulfilling life, do it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I'm going to have to wrap up soon because I am starting to flake out.
No problem.
So if anyone has any super chats, please post them now. In the meantime, we will do... okay, someone says, I don't have a question, just wanted to wish both of you a Merry Christmas. Glad to see you back, Woz. I've missed your videos and these... I think he means millennial, have been great. Thank you very much. Can't wait to see what you do in the new year. Thank you very much. All right. So here are some questions. They're not super chats, but they're questions. Is lower population density in North America a difficulty as far as organizing? Yes, I think it is. Basically, people are very isolated and spread out, and it's difficult for people to attend gatherings. That's just too sparse. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've got anything to say about that, especially in the Canadian context.
It is, yes. Like, for example, one of the benefits you guys have in Britain is you can have a conference where, you know, all of your big names are there, but it's not really feasible because of geography. So yeah, it is a bit of a disadvantage, but maybe it's also an advantage in the sense that, you know, there's more places to kind of, I guess, find a nice local area where you can, you know, I guess, escape the madness of these big multicultural cosmopolitan cities. So, you know, there's positives and negatives to it, I'd say.
Yeah. Fari asks, have you been reading any books lately?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, War and Peace. Yeah, I've been reading that lately.
The Franklin was talking about that in the previous stream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've also read I've been doing a series of videos on the Enlightenment on my channel, and I've read this year several different authors, different books by them for that series.
Okay. Is the Red Ensign flag or Ensign flag an important issue anymore?
It's not really, because it's something that you see, like, they've done a real good job at you know, erasing our, you know, pre-1965 history, because a lot of people don't even know what it is. But it is kind of becoming our version of like a nationalist symbol. So it's implicitly a symbol of European Canada, because, I mean, that's what it is, really. And it's also kind of become controversial that a lot of people identify it as a far right symbol, which honestly
kind of like the equivalent of the Confederate flag.
It's the equivalent of the Confederate flag, which honestly I welcome it. I like it as our symbology. It's the flag I identify with that flag more than I would our national flag today.
Right. Okay.
It's the one that's on my wall.
Okay. Nice. Are Canadians black pilled compared to Americans? In my experience, I have to say they are.
I mean, in terms of the state of the country right now, yes, I'd say we are. But I guess, you know, my mentality is kind of that, like I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of looking for, you know, what can come new out of it. What new can we create? And I don't know what that's, well, I don't know what that's going to, I don't know what that's going to look like. So. In the case of like Canada as it exists and as it existed historically, yes, I'd say we are black-pilled, but you know, I'm a lot more, I guess, forward-looking. I'm more looking towards what's going to come next.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Now Robert adds, super chat. The Anglosphere at its heart is essentially European, periodically aligned, always home. I don't know what you mean by aligned. Aligned with Europe, the continent. Anyway, always home and feels like home. Well, that's a nice thought. And yes, okay. The Anglosphere at its heart is essentially European. Of course it is, but it is different from the continent. I mean, there is a distinction between the Anglosphere and continental Europe. Of course, then you would have to divide that, if you're to be fair, into Western Europe, Central Europe, and Eastern Europe. But I do think that the Anglosphere is something distinct. But obviously it's European. Of course it is, because we're Europeans. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Would you agree that mixing is inherently bad? I think it's not optimal. I think it's not preferable. It's better if things are maintained and sustained. But I think a small minority, for example, is a tiny minority of people who race mix, if that's what you mean. I'm not going to get too worked up about it, although there's just questions of integration identity. I would not want it to become something that was normal, you know, like the normal thing to do. Definitely not. I think it's always preferable to maintain what you've been given, what you've been born with. As for mixing between different European countries, yeah, again, I think it would be preferable if the different European ethnicities were maintained. What I was saying earlier is that at this point, I think the cat might already be out of the bag. So that's, again, there's a lot to be said about that. Endeavor, would you agree that mixing is inherently bad?
I'd say, if in terms of preserving a culture, yes. But at the same time, I stand by my previous statement that, you know, it's not something I'm going to be asinine over. You know, it's already kind of happening. And, you know, I think that I'm not one to really purity spiral over that, though. I would say that, you know, in terms of the advertisements you see today with, you know, that every single time it's like the black man with the white woman. Okay. Everyone knows that that's propaganda and that it is meant to be anti-white. So yeah, obviously yeah. I'm not in favor of that, but I basically stand by my previous statement on it.
Yeah. I would also say that there are specific reasons not to mix, but when certain parties are involved, let's put it that way. Also, that there are, of course, there are identity issues for the kids, which is a reality. But even me, you know, even I have identity issues, clearly, in some sense. I don't know. A lot of them perhaps are imaginary. Perhaps you just sort of make life more complicated than it needs to be. I wouldn't be surprised at all if I'm doing that, because I've got a pretty bad habit of doing that. Then the other thing is medical things. It is difficult to get organs and so on, donations, I think even blood donations for mixed race people. I mean, that's a fact. So in that sense, of course, it's less desirable. One thing I would have to say is that the left often spread this idea of hybrid vigor, which is, as far as I know, it's utter bullshit, because there's evidence for it in plants, but not in mammals. And not in humans. The evidence that they use for humans is that they'll say that the children of mixed parents, the children of mixed couples, are more intelligent than the average child. I think there was this study done in Africa or something. But that does not mean that it raises intelligence. If you wanted to prove that it raises intelligence, you'd have to say that these kids were more intelligent than their parents. But as far as I know, that has never been demonstrated, let alone clinically proven. So what they are is more intelligent than the average child in Africa. But, that just means that the parents more likely to race mix in Africa are high IQ parents, are high IQ people. Yeah. So it doesn't prove what... If I'm right about... If I have understood... the literature correctly, then it doesn't at all establish that race mixing raises IQ and whatever. Indeed, as far as I know, in America, it's exactly as you would expect it to be. If the average black American is IQ is 85 and the average white IQ is 100, then most of the children, they average out at exactly between those two, which I think is 92.5. So it's actually exactly as you would expect it. It's just one study where they showed this in Africa. But again, it I don't think it proves what they say it proves at all. So, yeah, okay. Now, what are some of the best reactionary books, aside from Mold Bug, that you would recommend for people who are serious about learning the issues?
One of them I liked was Why Liberalism Failed by Patrick Deneen. He goes into a lot about the kind of the atomization and he uses the phrase anti-culture for the culture that liberalism created. Kind of what I mentioned at the beginning, the inauthenticity of modern culture. And he goes over a lot of the ways that liberalism is set up. And what his conclusion was is that it didn't fail because it failed because it succeeded to do what it claimed it was going to do, and that it's really just kind of empty in the end. So that is a good one. Another one I'd say is Edmund Burke, Reflections on the Revolution in France. That was one I rather enjoyed. And I guess another reactionary another essential one is Dark Enlightenment by Nick Land. I'm sure everyone's probably read that one by now. And G.K. Chesterton's another good reactionary author. I really enjoyed the book Orthodoxy. So that, there's a few examples. Oh, one of my favorites also is Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes. He's one of my favorite philosophers.
All right. One that just occurred to me is the Screwtape Letters. Have you read? I haven't read it, but have you read it?
No, I haven't, actually.
It's one of the ones I really want to read because I think it sounds really fantastic from what I've heard and what the bits that I've read. I'm very interested in it. I think there is one last question. So just let me get this. And, this is about... Okay. Oh, no, I think that's them all, actually. Hold on a second. So, finally, are there any other things that you would like to say about, what we were talking about originally? Here's another question. Where would Endeavor live within America if he were ever to emigrate to the U.S.?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I'd say probably... I really want to kind of live in one of the cotton states, to be honest, maybe like one like Alabama or Alabama probably. I just kind of love the redneck culture, the gun culture. Or another one that's actually really nice is Utah or Montana. You know, nice land. They're relatively, they're a lot more homogenous than a lot of the other states, certainly more than the cotton states. It'd be a nice place, probably be a nice place to live. It's pretty conservative out there. So I'd say either Montana, Utah, or maybe one of the southern ones.
Yeah. He also asks where I would want to live in America if I moved to America. And I don't see myself ever doing that. Not because I hate it or anything. I just don't. I think it's too. I want to live in Britain. I'm happy living in Britain, and so it's difficult. I don't know it well enough to say this is the place I'd want to live in America. So I can't answer that question. I simply don't. It would be like just choosing a random place. Really, I wish I could give you a more substantial and interesting answer than that. I definitely wouldn't want to live in the South just because climate-wise it wouldn't match up with me. So all I can say is the North. Totally boring answer. I'm sorry. All right, so that's that. Okay, any final thoughts, Endeavor?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say thanks again for having me on this year. It's always a pleasure. And, I think that kind of, if you want me to relate it back to what I was talking about at the beginning, I think the reason everyone loves Melanie Yule is that it's really authentic. It makes everyone feel almost like it's, I guess, the end of the year dissident right Christmas party, I guess you could say. So, yeah, just big thanks for having me on and look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on. So, all right, someone's saying that I would love Portland and I should just be honest about it, the hipster stuff. Well, yeah, maybe. I also quite like Seattle, but I've heard from that, Seattle's a bit of a dump nowadays and has been for several years. And, I don't know. It rained a lot and I like places where it rains a lot. So that's that. Anyway, so let's leave it now. That was Endeavor. And this was another good night. Tomorrow I will be back with Libertas Metapolitics, Black Pilled, The After Party, and then Nightmares. So I will see you then. And in the meantime, this was Endeavor. And I'm signing off now and going to bed because I'm very tired. So thank you, Endeavor, for taking part in Millennial 2019.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and thanks to everyone for watching. See you tomorrow.